Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
This week on Meet and Three, we rethink surplus by exploring how innovators are promoting sharing mindsets and responding to excess in creative ways.
The whole life cycle of food would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter behind China and the United States if it were a country.
You know, in the age of COVID, where a lot of those institutional processors did grind to a halt and a lot of farms had to dump milk in Pennsylvania, even while supermarket cases were bare, the organic market stayed strong.
They source all of these ingredients, they do all of this work, and then they just boil it for a few minutes and then they throw it away.
Tune in to Meet and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we are catching up with one of my very, very, very favorite guests, Leah Douglas from the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Leah, in case you haven't caught a podcast with her before, is a journalist covering food and agriculture from Washington, D.C. She focuses on corporate power, my favorite topic, consolidation, another favorite, regulation, big business and political economy, as those subjects relate to food, agriculture, labor, land, and the environment. She is an associate editor and staff writer at the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and she has written for numerous publications, including The Washington Post, The Nation, The Guardian, Washington Monthly, Mother Jones, Fortune, Time Slate, Pacific Standard, The Oregonian, DCist, and elsewhere. She was the 2020 recipient of the National Farmers Union Milt Haeckel Award for Excellence in Agricultural Reporting, and well-deserved, and was a member of the 2019-2020 cohort of the New Economies Reporting Project Finance Solutions Fellowship. Welcome back to the show, Leah. It's been a few months. I've missed you. How have you been?
Thanks so much for having me back. I've been doing all right, better now that spring has started.
Yeah, definitely better now. What a rugged winter that was. I happened to be rolling around the upstate New York for most of the winter. Well, for 5 weeks, sort of waiting out the polar vortex. And I can say with authority that I have not shoveled that much snow since I was a very young person. It was a nightmare. It frickin' snowed every other day. And it didn't just dust. It was like 2 to 4, 4 to 6, 6 to 8 inches every other day. A nightmare from my point of view. And I do not, in case any of you were wondering, do not do winter sports. So, yeah, I did not greet those snowfalls with joy. Anyway, we are going to talk today about a story you published in FERN, Food and Environment Reporting Network, on March 8th about the Farmer John processing plant owned by the Smithfield Company. And I'm just curious, like, after all the reporting you've done, because you and I have, you know, basically checked in almost every month for about a year now, what drew you to this story in particular?
Well, the outbreak that's been going on at the Farmer John plant, which is in Los Angeles County, there's a couple of sort of unique things about that facility and that outbreak. I mean, first of all, you know, Los Angeles County is not necessarily the place that would come to mind first when folks are thinking about meatpacking.
No.
So the fact that this is an urban environment, the part of the county that it's in is very industrial. So there's a lot of other manufacturing plants there as well. And it's been there's been a lot of outbreaks in that. The city is named Vernon. In Los Angeles County, there's been a lot of manufacturing-related outbreaks of COVID there. So it's an interesting, unique place to be looking in terms of workplace safety in general. Mm-hmm. And this outbreak has also been going on for many, many months, one of the longest running outbreaks that I've been tracking, and also just massive in its scope. Nearly half of the workforce has been infected with COVID, and it's also the outbreak picked up pace this winter, which is, you know, a time that a lot of other outbreaks at meatpacking facilities appeared to be slowing. This outbreak was speeding up. So there's a few different reasons that we thought looking into this plant and how it's been managed by the city and by the state would be an interesting case study for where are we in the winter months as we were approaching the year mark of COVID, what's happening at some of these facilities.
Yeah, right. And then, because it is, as you say, located in a manufacturing hub in a very urban area of California, the Los Angeles County, were you able to tell whether the spread of the disease was from plant to community, or was it, as Smithfield tried to push back, from the community to the plant? I guess, does that even matter, really, when all is said and done?
Well, that distinction of what constitutes, a workplace-related case of COVID is hugely controversial. As you know, we've talked about, and I'm sure listeners are aware, that's definitely been, a topic that's been litigated, that has ongoing litigation, that's related to whether workers can get workers' compensation benefits or their families can get benefits if the workers die of COVID. So that's really a critical question. And it varies a lot by health department, how the agency is making that distinction. So I, as a reporter, just following, what the LA County Health Department has identified as a workplace case. LA County, one of the reasons that this story was also, we wanted to pursue the story is one of the few counties in the country releasing, very detailed data on businesses that have had COVID outbreaks. So we're able to track over many months, the state of this outbreak, and they have their own methodology for defining a workplace outbreak, which is explained on their website.
Right, right. And then they use that methodology, Smithfield uses it essentially to contest fines and legal action and presumably the onus to, compensate workers who have fallen ill or died. Am I right in that?
Yes, the meat industry has consistently said that, in a lot of instances of outbreaks that, it's not clear whether workers are contracting the illness at the plant or in the community, and whether, outbreaks are originating from workers who were ill already and brought the virus into the facility versus being infected at the facility and bringing it back to the community. So this question of whether it's workplace spread or community spread has recurred often in my reporting this past year. And, workplace safety advocates and unions and other public health experts have made the point that, in many cases, the rate of spread is so significant at these facilities that it is an outlier compared to, other types of, places where people are coming into contact within the community. But also that, employers have a certain responsibility towards their workers, regardless of, whether the source of the outbreak is inside or outside of the plant. So, again, right, all those questions are constantly evolving even still.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things your investigation showed in reporting on this particular plant was that they have inconsistently reported their cases, meaning, I guess, that, for a while they were reporting very diligently, and then there seemed to be some sort of guidance from the local public health officials that they didn't really need to do that anymore. And then maybe they were required to then do it again. I didn't quite understand that. But I'm wondering how you figured out that there were inconsistencies in the caseload that they were reporting, and were there other violations that you uncovered in finding that out?
Sure. So we had some public records that were obtained through a FOIA request that showed emails between city and state health officials and. Or I should say city and county health officials and the management at the Smithfield plant. And one element that those emails revealed was that the city of Vernon had a couple-week period in the last spring where its direction to Smithfield around, whether and how to report worker illness changed. The plant had been reporting illnesses to the city with a lot of regularity, and then a city health official cited President Trump's executive order from April, which, declared meatpacking infrastructure to be critical infrastructure using the Defense Production Act. to say, you know, we don't need you to report cases anymore to the city. A few weeks later, after consulting with the county health department, the city official walked back that direction and said, actually, please do resume reporting cases. So I think the big picture there is there was a lot of confusion in the spring, you know, when this outbreak was underway. You know, dozens of workers were already infected. There was confusion around whether and how Smithfield should report to the city, to the county, to the state. And all of those different levels of authority had different expectations of the plant, plus this federal order around which, as we've discussed, there's been a lot of controversy, a lot of litigation. What did that you know, DPA order mean in terms of mm-hmm. what the industry had to do to be in compliance? So that was one element that we uncovered through the FOIA request. Additionally, as a state health authority, the state OSHA office had its own fine of the Smithfield facility for not properly reporting worker cases. We didn't get a lot of transparency into what exactly that meant, but we do have the fine from the state. So again, the big picture there is that, you know, there's been not consistent requirements at the federal level by any means for companies or states to report, you know, worker illness in this sector. So there's been a lot of variation at down to the city level in a lot of different places for what's expected of these companies and when they're in compliance and when they're not. And the result of that is, you know, anywhere from confusion, miscommunication, to, you know, express taking advantage of loopholes and violating orders that are in place on the part of the companies.
And what about now with the Biden administration? Have they had, you know, the bandwidth to address some of those requirements to make them more transparent, more obvious, more consistent across the board?
I have not seen any new directive from the Biden administration related mm-hmm. to standardizing reporting of workplace outbreaks. That's still something that's being negotiated at the state level, as far as I know. There has been administrative efforts around workplace safety that extend into the regulatory sphere, but not the data reporting, as far as I've seen.
Right, right. And then there was another thing that plants were also found to have testing and quarantine failures. What you know, describe what they were doing. I mean, they were testing, then they weren't testing, or they would test, and if somebody had a negative test, they'd send them into the workplace, even if they had been exposed. You know, talk a little bit about that, because that was sort of alarming.
Yeah, so this was another, you know, incident that we uncovered with the public records request. So there was some communication between a county health official and the management of the Smithfield facility last June related to the company's practice at the time of, you know, if a employee was exposed to a coworker with COVID-19, so they were in close contact, you know, within a small distance of this infected coworker for an extended period of time, the plant was testing the worker, and if the test was negative, allowing them to return to work. At the time, the state health order was to quarantine that worker for 10 days, even if the test was negative. So remember, at the time, you know, there was, you know, 2-week quarantine recommended by the CDC in general for exposure to COVID. And the state order was, you know, in a workplace context, this person has to be quarantined for 10 days. So the practice of testing once and getting one negative test and having no quarantine was in violation of a state health order. The company did say that, you know, it complied with mandates issued by the local health departments. A city health official told us that after this direction in June from the county to end this practice of the one negative test, that the company did get into compliance with that county directive. So again, that just gives us a little bit more insight into last spring, you know, what was going on at this facility and how are decisions being made about whether and how to test and quarantine workers even after they'd been exposed to COVID.
Right, right. And of course, I mean, in a way, you know, much as I love to heap scorn upon, you know, these companies, with the plethora of confusing instructions, miscommunications, and of course, the overall incentive to maintain profits, you know, you really can't blame them for not having it completely 100% correctly done. So now by November of this past year, following a 6-month investigation, you cited in your article, California OSHA, which is the Occupational Safety and Hazard Administration discovered that there were inadequate training, masking, and distancing protocols within the plant. And by that time, I'm wondering how many workers in the, I mean, because it seems to me by, okay, in the first 6 months of the pandemic, right, nobody knows what the hell is going on. Fair enough. But by November, I think we had a pretty good bead on how things were supposed to be handled. And yet, somehow, there didn't seem to be any robust masking, training, distancing protocols in the plant. And so I'm wondering how many workers sort of from the summer on ended up getting sick or dying. And more importantly, how many since that report was issued? In other words, since November, there's still been a lot of people getting sick. Am I right?
Yes. So in November, Cal/OSHA brought a fine against, against Smithfield for violations of this plant. It was about a $100,000 fine, which was at the time, and I believe still is the largest citation that's been brought against a meatpacking plant by a safety and health administration agency, federal or state. Right. And at the time, there were more than 315 worker cases at the facility. And, you know, it's worth noting with the 6 month investigation, you know, means that these violations happened at any point. We don't have the granular, or I don't have the granular information from Cal/OSHA as to, you know, when exactly those violations happened. So it could have been at any point in the 6 months prior. But, you know, since, you know, one of the reasons to return to, you know, why were we investigating this plant? You know, 315 cases as of last November. Today, according to Los Angeles County Health Department that I just checked right now, there's been 796 cases at this facility. So more than twice the number since that fine and citation. So, you know, one of the crucial questions facing OSHA this year has been one of the major criticisms, I should say, of OSHA is that, you know, the fines levied against these companies have been a minuscule fraction of their, annual profits, say, you know, for comparison. And a lot of, you know, a lot of critics have said that OSHA should bring greater fines. What's the utility of the fines has been, you know, an active question. So it's an interesting data point that at this facility, since the fine in November, cases have more than doubled. So, we've been able to see that, it's just an interesting, gives us some more information about what does the fine do to incentivize the company one way or another.
Well, when it's $100,000 or 50, some of the other fines were like $13,000, $15,000. I mean, these are laughable in the context of a company like Smithfield that is generating hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue every year with, you know, probably at least half of that being net profit. So it's kind of staggering that even an organization that is supposed to be involved in worker safety and health can't bring themselves to drop the hammer a little more forcefully. You know, I mean, $100,000 is nothing to one of these guys. Absolutely. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Leah Douglas talking more about COVID and meatpacking and more of the same. Stay tuned.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Wisconsin cheese has proven time and time again to be a delicious expression of craft, hard work, and tradition. As a Cheeselandian, I am able to share a Gouda experience with fellow cheese and food lovers nationwide, as well as connect with cheese producers and cheesemongers, taking my love of cheese to another level. I invite you to join Cheeselandia because during these difficult times, it has been even more important to take it easy and get cheesy. The Cheeselandia community and events have been the glue helping to keep us together and connected, and I would love it if you would join me. And let's face it, if you hear the word cheese and get a little hungry, then you've found a place you can call home. To find out more about Cheeselandia, go to cheeselandia.com.
So, you have been creating the big map of outbreaks since last spring. And I wondered, because you haven't been on for a couple of months now, would you remind listeners of the number of outbreaks at Smithfield? I'm not asking across the board in the meatpacking industry, but just Smithfield overall. What about their numbers in terms of workers infected, fatalities? Do you have any data on that?
Yes. So throughout the pandemic, according to the data I've collected, there's been 14 outbreaks that I've been able to tie to Smithfield facilities in the past year. And at those outbreaks, they have been tied to over 3,600 cases and 13 deaths among workers. That's according to data that I've aggregated from news reports and from public health agencies.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. The union president, John Grant, the union that represents meatpacking workers, has pointed to initial cooperation at the Farmer John plant in terms of reporting, you know, cases and so forth. But then he's reported that the Farmer John executives began to lawyer up. What do you mean by that? Or what did he mean by that, to be more accurate?
Yes, so this is John Grant, the president of UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 770, which works in Los Angeles County. And, the report that John Grant had was that, you know, initially there was cooperation from the company in terms of trying to address the initial outbreak last spring. But ever since, the process has been, quote, exasperating, he said. And I believe he was referring to generally, the company's approach to, you know, as more outbreaks arose and more workers got sick, corporate strategy and maybe less cooperation from the plant managers. And Grant had said in my interview with him several weeks ago that workers were still struggling to access. They're still have been asked to reuse masks and gloves at the facility after
Incredible.
Struggling for months to access PPE. And that, you know, which is, and this is a common concern still at meatpacking plants, that, workers are still in incredibly close quarters. He alleged there haven't been staggered break times to allow for more distancing among workers. So the cafeteria or in break rooms, workers are in extremely close quarters. He said, quote, the breaks and lunches are like petri dishes.
Right.
And worth noting, Smithfield has said that, the company has provided PPE to workers and that it has staggered break and lunch times. But again, that's the report from the union president, that they're not seeing that consistently.
Right, right. And then in November, the state of California issued an emergency temporary standard. And that would be something that, you know, tells meatpacking companies that they must enforce distancing, testing, training. So training, you know, being like you got to stay 6 feet apart and you have to wash your hands, I guess. I don't know, wear your PPE. But I thought that ETS that calls for those, you know, protocols was already the norm. So did they institute that? Did the state issue that ETS because of the Cal OSHA report in November? Or were there just no protocols in place before that? And this was like, oh, my goodness, I guess we need to do this.
So this is a critical question for national regulation of these facilities also.
Yeah.
So essentially what's been happening for the past year is that the CDC and OSHA have had guidelines for these facilities to follow in terms of distancing workers, providing PPE, testing regimens, and so on. But those guidelines are not requirements, so they're not enforceable. It's more like a framework that the industry can use for its COVID response. There's been a lot of agitation among workplace safety advocates, unions, Democratic lawmakers to have a federal enforceable standard that these companies and plants would have to meet in order to protect workers from the spread of COVID. And that's not just at meatpacking facilities, that's for all
Sure.
workplaces.
Right.
There's been a lot of, as I said, agitation for a federal emergency temporary standard from federal OSHA that would have these requirements. Meanwhile, there are many, about half of states have state OSHA, so they're not under the umbrella of federal OSHA, but rather under a state OSHA department. And so in California, the state went ahead and passed its own ETS, which essentially mandates what was previously a recommended guideline. So mm-hmm. we're still in the early months of seeing the enforcement of that ETS. It went into effect in December 1. And Cal OSHA has since opened a second investigation into this Farmer John facility. So, you know, now they have the framework, investigators have the framework of the ETS to potentially bring some new enforcement actions against that facility and other companies in the state that might be violating the ETS. I haven't seen a lot of news about, you know, how that's been implemented yet, but it's definitely something that workplace safety advocates in the state are eager for, you know, for the ETS to be able to bring some more teeth to how these workplace safety requirements are actually being implemented in workplaces.
And you know what's interesting, and you know, this is completely off the cuff here, but as I sent you that press release from the North American Meat Institute saying that, you know, COVID worker, you know, COVID cases in amongst meatpacking workers are down, you know, X number of percent. And they've, you know, they have implemented all these various, you know, testing, training, PPE, blah, blah, blah. And yet you're saying you've just made it clear that with the exception of the state of California and maybe one or two others, these are, as you said, guidelines. There is no enforcement possible with, you know, with these protocols. It's just, you know, if you choose to do this as a company or a corporation, if you choose to adopt these things, well, then, you know, that's a great public relations thing, but you don't actually have to. So I'm just, you know, I just want to marvel at the fact that your own work actually is being quoted by the North American Meat Institute in support of how wonderfully well they're doing in reducing their caseload. I mean, I find the irony of that absolutely breathtaking. Did you want to comment on that, or should we just move on?
Sure. No, I mean, I've said publicly that, you know, the Meat Institute's use of the data I've been collecting for Fern to show essentially what the Meat Institute is saying, their analysis is taking the number of daily cases that I've been reporting among meatpacking workers over the past several months and comparing that to data reported by the New York Times in terms of, you know, new cases in the entire U.S. population per 100,000 people and saying that comparing meatpacking workers to the national infection rate, meatpacking workers have significantly lower infection rate per capita than nationally. And I've said publicly several times that this is a misleading analysis because the data available from the New York Times is extremely comprehensive from all 50 states. The data that I'm collecting is extremely not comprehensive. It's the best we have available, but very few states are releasing granular information about worker cases by occupational sector. And in large part, in many states, that's because of pressure from business interests, including at some times, you know, potentially the meat industry, to not release that information about worker illness. And I've requested many times that the meat industry and meat companies, you know, release that data to me. And also congressional investigators, members of Congress have asked for that data, and it has not been released. So it's sort of comparing apples and oranges, essentially, because we have an extremely limited data set on worker illness in the meatpacking sector compared to the comprehensive information we have about population-wide illness.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, yeah, one has to give a tip of the hat to the formidable spin that they've been able to bring to bear on that. There was another story that you referenced in your Twitter account, which I picked up on, that was published in the Fresno Bee, about a couple of Foster Farms poultry processing plants. And they made it, in the story, it was made clear that Cal OSHA was actually informing the plants in advance of their intention to inspect them. Now, is that normal? Does that always happen? Does OSHA say, "Oh, hey, you know, John Q. Processor, I'm going to come in with my team on Tuesday, and we're going to inspect for COVID. Like, you know, so get ready." I mean, like, how does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I'm not familiar enough with OSHA inspections at the federal or state level to make a sweeping generalization. I know that there are instances in which inspections are announced and there are other instances in which they're unannounced. And I would really recommend folks check out that story in the Fresno Bee about how the investigations at these Foster Farm plants underwent, because I think there's some, the reason I found that story really compelling was how it shows how much confusion, and miscommunication there's been at different points between all the different levels of regulation around these facilities, like it was talking about with the Farmer John plant as well. And that, you know, even with good intentions, you know, an investigator in that case giving advance notice to the facility created a lot of distrust in what was going to come from that investigation. So I do think that, again, that's one example of a question that is applying, that can be applied broadly to a lot of meatpacking plants that I've heard people talk about across the country, which is when we're having these inspections, you know, are they happening and sort of, you know, again, announced or unannounced? Are the conditions that workers experience day to day going to be represented on the day of the inspection, or is it going to be, you know, sort of cleaned up because, you know, the company knows that inspectors are coming? So that's a critical question of workplace safety oversight that existed far before the pandemic, but, you know, of course, is under the spotlight now as well.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, in that Fresno Bee piece, they also quoted a worker who said that, and this is not in, you know, not reflected in the inspection process, but they said that the break rooms, you know, which of course Foster Farms was like, yes, we're complying with all the regulations. They had removed all the tables and chairs from the break rooms, but the workers were just sitting on the floor, you know, right next to each other, just as they would have been in a chair on a table. I mean, you know, it was just, okay, yeah, I can see you really did a great job there. So in that same piece, we were also told that the Merced County Health Department was skeptical of the outbreak information being provided by Foster Farms. And I was wondering, Leah, how in fact could those numbers be verified? I mean, by Cal OSHA or any other body? Like, how could you, you know, since you've been reporting on this since last March, is there any mechanism by which a county or state health authority is able to verify information that is fed to them by meat processing companies?
You know, this is a great question. And I think, unfortunately, the unsatisfying answer is that it really depends. Yeah. Again, this is a place where it's really worth hammering home how variable these processes are from county to county, city to city, health department to health department. There is no standardized process through which any health entity, you know, state to state is collecting, you know, test or case, I should say, illness information by occupational sector. So, you know, whether a county is collecting, you know, a person's place of employment when they get tested at a county health site, for instance, is hugely variable. Whether that person was tested on site at their workplace and then that workplace is reporting that information to the health department, you know, that's another method through which that information is getting to a health agency. But, right, you know, those two testing scenarios are very different. So, you know, in this story, you know, it was reported that there was some skepticism. You know, I've reported on other instances where it seems that there's a very close and, you know, trusting relationship between the meat company and the health agency, that this information is being reported very quickly, you know, day to day or week to week. And I have no reason to believe that the information is inaccurate. I have no way to know. But I do think that it's, again, an important piece of data, and seeing how that variation can create a lot of question marks around the validity of the data that we're getting and just how irregular and inconsistent that data is.
Right. And so the job after the pandemic is over, the job is to figure out how to create a mechanism by which these reporting, you know, reporting this kind of data is standardized, is verifiable, and is trustworthy. Because, I mean, honestly, I could easily see why these people are, you know, they can fudge those numbers. Who's going to check it out? Who's going to really know? How are they going to figure it out? They may not be. I'd love to give them the benefit of the doubt, as you seem to. But I'm, you know, I'm much far too old and cynical to do so. So anyway, since March 1st, meatpacking workers have been sent to the very top of the list to get vaccinated. Do you have any insight into how that is rolling out and whether companies have been able to secure the vaccines they need? And then also whether or not workers are willing to accept the vaccine?
Yeah, so this is definitely one of the biggest topics right now in this conversation. Yeah. You know, the question of worker vaccination, or the issue, I should say, of worker vaccination has really united meat companies with worker unions. There's really been a unified call that these workers need to be prioritized in early phases of vaccine distribution. There's been some frustration that states have veered away from the CDC's recommendation to put, you know, food manufacturing workers in phase 1B. So that's an early phase of vaccine distribution in every state. And some states have shifted, you know, in the past several months to, you know, more of an age-based criteria that has deprioritized these manufacturing workers, but in more and more states, you know, food processing and meat processing workers are becoming eligible, especially in March. And so there's been, you know, a lot of these companies are vaccinating workers on site and on site, you know, vaccine clinics. Many of the biggest right. meatpacking facilities have on site health clinics that have already been doing worker testing. So they're adding vaccination, to that process. There's not, again, another data issue. There's no sort of standardized, data collection, by any, you know, public authority that's, keeping track of where these vaccination events are, how many workers have been vaccinated.
Really?
But I've been trying to just sort of follow news reports, and, the news reports that I've seen of, you know, many of these vaccination events indicate that there's been a lot of uptake among workers, you know, you know, very popular, especially, when workers can get vaccinated on site. And I know that, UFCW in my interviews with them has encouraged these on-site vaccine clinics because it just reduces another hurdle to vaccination. You know, the vaccination process is definitely underway. You know, I've heard from many workplace safety advocates that, you know, they're really really driving home that vaccination is just one tool to curtail the pandemic's, the virus's spread among these workers. You know, it will be still many, many weeks before, you know, an entire before the vaccine is fully distributed to this workforce, before it's, you know, everyone in sure. every state is eligible. And also, even then, just as population-wide, you know, not every single person who's eligible will be vaccinated. And additionally, you know, this is an industry with a relatively high turnover rate, so there'll be new workers coming into the facilities. So, you know, labor advocates are saying, you know, plants and companies need to have strategy for ongoing vaccination. And in the meantime, you know, keeping up masking, testing, and other prevention protocols to curtail the spread of the virus. So those are all issues that I'll be watching closely in the next few months.
Well, and you'll be coming back to tell us about them in the next few months.
Absolutely.
I look forward to it. Leah, thank you so, so much. This is your moment to encourage people to go to Fern or your website or wherever to learn more about your work. Go right ahead.
Sure. Thanks, Katie. So if folks want to read more of my reporting and Fern's reporting on COVID spread, these, you know, food processing facilities, and we're covering the pandemic more broadly as well, you can go to thefern.org. And you can always check out my Twitter at Leah J. Douglas for the latest updates and information there as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Leah. I really appreciate your time today. Thanks to my sponsor, and thank you folks for listening. We'll see you next week with another show. Have a good one.
What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.